Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuckables? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. If you're new, hi, how are you? Hope you're comfortable. Hope you're doing what you just normally do. You're just trying it out. Like, I've heard about this guy. People say he's good. One guy says he's annoying. They say his interviews are good, but sometimes he's a little rambly at the beginning. Yeah, welcome. For those of you who have been here before, nice to see you. Nice to have you back. What's going on today on the show? Jeff Daniels. I talked to Jeff Daniels, the actor, who in that it turns out to be kind of a great conversation, really. I think he surprised himself. Last night was the last night of Hanukkah, and the night before last, I lit the candles. It was pretty exciting to light so many, to start out with so many. You know, because I started out with seven. I didn't light them until last night. That was the night that, you know, I've been busy, been doing Globe and getting home late. I've been studying my lines with Sarah the painter, came over, and she wanted to witness it. And I begrudgingly did it. And I'm sorry that it was begrudgingly, but sometimes it's just a vulnerable place. I talked about that last week, but I did it. And the pretty hand-dipped Hanukkah candles made a very compelling, colorful mess. And my smoke alarm did not go off. I said the prayer the best I could, did not know the second one, dug up my yarmulke from the drawer where I have a couple that I've collected from weddings, and then one nice woven one where I don't remember where I bought it, but I must have bought it somewhere. And I laid into it. I leaned in to the menorah lighting ceremony. I have been trying to use my time efficiently, working all week, doing the glow. Been some late shoots going into the night, and a couple nights I got home, but then I get home when I'm doing the show and I work on the scenes for the next day, and I've kind of relaxed into the process. God knows I should, this being the third year, but it's going well. But then the weekend comes and I want to get some shit done. There's some stuff that needs to get done, house stuff, things, you know, making my new house a house still needs to be done. Like I have this room upstairs. It's supposed to be an office, so I want it to be an office, not just, you know. Well, here's my problem. Is like there's about, it starts out like three or four things I want to do, and then instead of just doing one at a time, I'll start doing one, and then I'll drift, and then I'll go do something else. I'll play guitar. I'll think about stuff. I'll read a book, and then I'll go do some of the other, and I just sort of create this multitasking rotation of projects, and then it becomes bigger as the day goes on because you find other things. Like this weekend, the idea was to get the office, the study or whatever, the room that I'm going to allot for work in my home, to get it set up. And by set up, I mean just file all this stuff that is now in piles on the floors and get it out of the way and make it look, you know, at least neat. And then I could start putting stuff in my desk. So the room looks like it functions and doesn't just become a storage room for a growing pile of papers and things that are in the, do I need all this shit limbo? I get a lot of shit. Do you understand? Then this stuff is all over the house. I don't know where it all comes from. I don't know how it just start, you know, just all of a sudden there's new things. I mean, I know that, you know, people and companies, publishers, record labels, they send me shit, books, records, you know, then people send me gifts and they have people send me big ideas and I look at them and then I put them on the table or the floor and they enter the first realm that they enter. The first circle is really the, I might want to keep this shit. That's the first level. And they can stay there for a while and for years even. And then eventually it gets to the point where when I decide, like I did this weekend, that it's time to go through this stuff, that they enter the, do I need all this shit limbo? And I'll tell you, man, it can be a little overwhelming because like I'm in my office, I'm going through papers. I go, cause I, you know, I have all this stuff that was unfiled. You know, I'm going through bank statements, insurance stuff, pay stubs, receipts for things that happened a long time ago. You know, my birth certificate. I got the deed to the old house. I got the deed to the new house. I got two marriage licenses, both of them void at this point, obviously. I got this huge folder of panic papers and like this aggressive documentation I did and all the actions I had to execute when my identity was stolen. I got random song lyrics. I got question sheets for podcasts, notes for interviews, just all over the place. You know, so can I'm sure that some of you can relate to this. And then there's the stacks of books and everything. It's just sort of like, do I need all this shit? And you don't want to throw important papers away. Why am I holding on to the marriage licenses? That stuff has to be done. That's over, right? But they're on official pieces of paper that are issued by the state. It's almost like it seems important. It seems like it's a for archival purposes. Am I ever going to need proof of that? I don't know. Who do I call? Who do I call to find out whether I need all this shit? Whether I can start shredding and throwing stuff away? Why do we hold on to it? Don't things lose their meaning or their importance? How long do you have to keep this stuff, man? So I'm making the rotation, the multitasking, you know, multi-floor, multi-room rotation, just moving around, folding laundry, going through a few piles of papers, looking at books on the dining room table. The paper thing just overwhelmed me. Yeah, I think it was the marriage licenses. I mean, then it's just sort of like, oh my God, life just stacks up. And I don't know that it made me feel bad, but it does. I guess it makes you feel reflective. I don't even know if it made me feel that. It's just sort of like I have lived a life. So in the middle of this rotation, I'm trying to read the new Beastie Boys book, which is great. And then a box came, delivered, new litter box. So I had to set that up and go through the litter and clean the litter and change the litter. I don't know, but I'm doing the papers. I'm doing the books. I'm changing cat litter. I'm playing guitar. I'm reading. Never one thing at a time. And I don't think I have to tell you, the piles are not done yet. They're smaller, but they're not done yet. So finally, I break down all the boxes. I get those in the recycle. That's part of the rotation now, breaking down boxes. And another box comes. And then I don't open it yet because I'm in the middle of the other thing. And then I notice that on the shelf with all my little bullshit tchotchkes, there's some old Mexican hand-carved winged monkeys that both of them lost their wings. I can't explain the whole story. So I'm like, all right, I've got the piles going on. I got the boxes going on. I got the reading going on. I've got folding laundry, everything. And I'm just like, hey, why not add gluing the wings onto the little monkeys? So I had two winged monkeys. I threw one away. It was irreparable. Both of these things, there's all these artifacts from trips I took with women who are no longer in my life, wives. And these things, they don't seem to be triggers. They're barely reminders at this point, just stuff I'm afraid to throw away. I feel like I go through this stuff every few years, but I'm happy that one of my monkeys now has wings. One of my little hand-carved, hand-painted, funny winged monkeys can now fly again. Oh, that must be what's going on. That must be what Buster's chasing around in the middle of the night. My little carved Mexican monkeys with wings come to life like Pinocchio and fly around my house again. Ah, the poetry. So the big question, how does this stuff keep reproducing? Why more stuff? Okay, so another box comes, as I mentioned, and I open it and I'd ordered a new vegetable steamer, just that thing that goes in the bottom of a pot, because the one I had was silicone And I don't know if you have this problem, but I've become very sensitive and very aggravated. I have a dishwasher. I don't always use it, but when I do use it, all the plastic takes, it all starts to smell and taste like that dishwasher soap. Like this dirty dishwater soap water. Maybe my dishwasher's fucked up. I don't know. Do you have this soap problem where your fucking plastic and even the glass stuff makes the food taste like soap? Is it my machine broken or is that a common problem? Get back to me on this. But I had this silicone, is that what it's called? I had to look it up. The silicone steamer that I have had for over a decade. And it just was making all my kale and vegetables and rob and everything I steam tastes like soap. So I was furious after a certain point. It's been going on for about a year. It took me that long to order a new steamer. And I ordered one that was too small for my big pot. So I had a moment of anger. And then there's the next moment when you order things online. It's like, did it cost enough to return it? No, it did not. It's like $6. So I went on and I ordered the larger one. And now I'm going to have two. And that's how things reproduce in the shopping online culture. Depending on how much time you have, you might like to return things. But I wasn't going to return it for $6. Now, in my mind, I'm like, that's good. I'll have two. One for the little pot and one for the big pot. But it'll only be a matter of time before it ends up in the do I need all this shit limbo. Two vegetable steamers. How often am I going to use one in a small pot? Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter, people. But I got two steamers now. So, Jeff Daniels... this interview that you're about to hear was recorded in the Schubert Theater during the first week of preview performances for To Kill a Mockingbird. That's a play adaptation of the Harper Lee book written by Aaron Sorkin. Opening night is this Thursday, December 13th. You know, it was great because it was one of those things. I was in New York. I brought my equipment. I met Brendan over at the Schubert Theater. We went up into the old offices that are beautifully redone in the Schubert. And we sat in this gorgeous room because I guess one of the Schuberts used to live there back in the day. And I set up on the table and Jeff brought his guitar in case we might want to do that. It's a little tricky to do that, but we noodled on it a bit before the interview. And we just talked, you know, and it's interesting because Jeff is an intense guy. But you enter an interview, and I know from someone who's doing them, with a sort of kind of like, all right, what are we doing? And it sort of started in that tone, but then it started to open up, and you can hear it open up. And we ended up having a really great conversation, a nice time, and we really connected. And there was a lot of great little tidbits about acting, about his career, about other actors, and just about, you know, his kind of journey as an act. Because everyone knows Jeff Daniels. He's a great actor. And the play was very good. What's horrible about the play is how relevant it is today. And I entered this thing, oddly enough, maybe it's because I was lazy in high school or I don't know, but I have not read To Kill a Mockingbird and I did not see the movie. So this play was actually my first experience with the story. And it's a devastating story, and it was very well executed by the actors and by Aaron Sorkin, who I'll talk to at another time. So this is me and Jeff Daniels upstairs at the old Schubert Theater in New York City. I saw it. Last night, yeah. How'd you feel about last night? I thought it was great, by the way.
We did well, but we had like 12 changes in the second act. So you're flying around speed bumps. Boom, there's one. Here comes a change. Don't forget what you're saying here about the, you know, you're thinking change, and then you go, I just word-burgered that line. Okay, here we go.
Let me make sure I got the piece out that was necessary to move the dialogue forward.
Yes.
What I meant to say.
Yes. Yeah. And something about Jim.
Yeah. Yeah. But you guys, he's got some of you, it seems like some of the actors have to push the stairs under the platform and then roll the thing out.
Yeah, and it's just things that are new. Everybody, Aaron and Bart and Scott are making it better. It's a bit of a, you want to shush down the mountain straight now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And we're not there yet. We have to.
Right.
And here's a new gate over here.
Are you changing every day? Like, are there tweaks? What kind of tweaks happen on a daily basis right now?
There are tweaks every day. Yeah, right now. Yeah.
To what? Lines, movements?
Cuts, all of it. Cuts.
Really?
Directing an actor to go deeper, and now he or she is now diving in deeper, and that changes the rhythm, so you're riding them and
right.
their changes, and you get the stairs instead of her getting the stair, you know, just stuff, just
right.
it's tightening the show, it's all the things you do with a new play to make it great.
And on top of that, it's Aaron Sorkin.
On top of that, it's the speed and the mental dexterity that it takes to handle Aaron Sorkin well.
Yeah,
and that's it's a challenge, and it's a great challenge.
But this is what, the third or fourth time you've worked with him?
Newsroom, I count that as 3 seasons, 3 years of doing exclusively Aaron's dialogue, and then it was Steve Jobs. And I don't think I'm forgetting anything. So this would be the third project, yeah.
And when you do, like, when you say, like, because I notice that Aaron, like, when I watch his stuff on, in a movie, like in Steve Jobs' movie,
mm-hmm.
like, I liken it to, like, you know, Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, that there's a patter to it.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
Like, it's not, it becomes about the rhythm of the patter, not whether or not people talk like that. It's like whether you can deliver his style of writing.
Yeah, I mean, it has to do with being a musician and finding the rhythm.
Yeah.
But it's also written.
Yeah.
Means it has to be rehearsed.
Right.
And I don't mind having the writer in the scene. I enjoy listening to Patty Chayefsky in Network.
Right.
I like that he's in the scene with Holden and Dunaway.
Yeah.
I don't mind that.
No, it's great.
I think... Too many actors have decided that, well, I think paraphrasing is best. And I think, let me just do it the way I would do it. And a lot of times you're in a movie where it's written by junior executives on the 18th floor and it's noted to death.
Yeah.
And you go through the scene and you're in the line and you're talking to your daughter and you say, you know, your mother, Nancy.
Yeah.
And you have to, and you're going, wait a minute, why am I telling my own daughter that her mother's name, because we're reminding the audience so late? Oh, shut up.
Right.
So with an Aaron Sorkin or a Chayefsky or David Mamet or Lanford Wilson, Preston Sturgis, let's go way back.
Yeah.
You want the writer in the room.
Yeah.
I'm reading a book. I want to know. I'm reading Paul Rudnick now. I love that I'm listening to Paul Rudnick and that other people are talking. What is wrong with that?
So right.
I've always, and it comes from the theater. It comes from.
There's a tone. There's a rhythm. There's something.
There's a respect for the writer.
They've perfected it. Trust me,
they've worked on this before they gave it to you.
Yeah.
And they might have tried all the things that you're going to do. And the actor thing of, well, let me do my, you're going to go down the road to your own little bag of tricks.
Yeah.
The thing that you do in every single movie that you think makes you special, that let me do what I do that America loves. Well, you're just a brand. Why don't you get inside Aaron Sorkin, get inside Atticus Finch.
Right.
And find out what that is and go to some place you've never been before. Otherwise, get the hell out.
Yeah.
Go do something else.
So do you, like, I've talked to Mamet about his approach to acting, which I initially, like, just on paper and having read, you know, what
I think I threw the book against the wall. Yeah.
Yeah, right. How he feels about it.
Yeah.
But I did take something away from that, is that it is on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you need is on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to honor that first.
Absolutely.
And then build it from inside that.
Don't change a word.
Right.
Especially a Mamet, a Lanford, or an Aaron Sorkin. Don't change a word of it. You're not allowed. In the theater, you are not allowed. In movies, somehow, somebody gave actors the permission to do that. I was doing a movie, The Hours, with Meryl Streep.
That's a heavy movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're with Meryl.
Right.
And I had worked with her on Heartburn, and I got the chance to do Hours and went over and did. We're walking into her apartment, the character's apartment, and the director, Stephen Daldry, said, Meryl, just say a couple things about your apartment as you're coming in. And she said, I have to write it too?
Yeah.
I had never heard an actor say that. And she goes, you have David Hare, one of the great screenwriters, sitting over there.
Yeah.
Go ask him. And Stephen rightly went over and said, David, and he's something, you know,
yeah,
you know,
right.
I hope you like it. Something, nothing, generic.
Right.
But, and he came two lines and she goes, thank you. And yeah. And I said, okay, that's it. That's done. That's, yeah. That's the role model. That's it. I get if it's written by 12 people and I get that. But if it, you got the real writer there, I did that on Looming Tower. We had Adam Rapp. Was a playwright and
yeah.
had written one of the episodes, and he was sitting over there and they're going, I go, Adam, come here. Yeah, tell him, what do you want me to say? Because that what it does for the actor then, you stop trying to do someone else's job. You stop trying to write it too. In between action and cut, you're also rewriting. Can't do it.
Right.
Can't do it.
Well, I had an experience with that the other day. Like I did, I'm not here to talk about me, but I do.
But
sometimes.
Let's.
Yeah. I did one scene, like a walk and talk with De Niro on the Joker movie. And I
pretty good.
Right. And I'd never been in that situation or on a set like that. But with De Niro, like we did the scene. And then he went over and talked to the director, who was Todd Phillips. And then I'm standing there. You know, I'm not saying anything. And then Todd Phillips comes over to me and goes, you think you're being a little too big? I think you might be a little too big. You know, you do work for Bob's character. And I'm like, oh, that's what he just thought. But I didn't take it personally. But De Niro didn't say to me.
No.
He
did the right thing. And on a film, too. And with somebody like De Niro, it's if Bob thinks you're a little big, you might want to bring it down.
Well, I was happy to bring it down.
Sure.
I did everything I could to bring it down.
So you were a complete zero. You were barely audible in the next take.
I didn't even talk. I just walked behind him nervously.
It's perfect.
Seemed like the right thing to do.
Sure.
Built it up from there. But do you ever improvise?
Yeah. When you're called upon to do so. I'm not good at it. I never took an improv class. So I'm okay at it. If I'm in the character and asked to, do something. I mean, when you're doing Dumb and Dumber with Jim Carrey, you better be ready to roll a little bit.
No,
but
yeah.
Often on Dumb and Dumber, I just go, Jim, give me something to say. When you say that, just give me something to say. You could try say this. Fine, thank you. Again, I don't want to write it.
It's your job to react to Jim Carrey.
I worked really hard to make it work the way it is. Now I'm supposed to, come on.
So when you started, where did you start doing the acting? I mean, when did it dawn on you that you needed to do that?
It's still dawning.
Yeah. But you've gotten very good at it.
Well, I kept waiting for it to end.
Yeah.
The career. I did. I was in high school.
There's still time, Jeff.
Trust me. They keep pulling me back. The high school, it was just a small town. They needed guys from South Pacific.
What town?
A little town called Chelsea, Michigan.
And that's where you live now.
I still live there, Ann Arbor, right near Ann Arbor. The director was doing South Pacific. She needed guys. So I'm walking off a basketball practice where we did nothing but run for 3 hours because we were 5-15.
Yeah.
And we had just lost by 30 points.
Oh,
and
good.
I'm one of the starters. And you're just going, just get me out of basketball.
Yeah.
And she's going, Jeff, get in here. Because I was in choir.
Right.
I could carry a tune.
Yeah.
She hauls me up there. I do a funny dance in the middle of, I don't know what the song was. And then next thing you know, I'm in the show. I do the funny dance and in front of 700 people, and I know exactly what to do, and I'm not nervous.
Right. And you don't have to make a shot.
Don't have to make a shot. And then she gives me Fagin and Oliver. Then she gives me, wait for it, Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof.
Sure.
Blonde.
Yeah.
Midwestern, 18. Not a clue what Jewish was. But I went to see the movie 6 times, so I did a dead-on impression of Topol.
Oh, good. I would have loved to have seen those costumes. I wonder how they would play today.
I remember spraying the blonde hair with gray hairspray paint and a glue-on gray beard.
And you did Zabadoo.
I did it all. But I knew what to do.
Yeah.
I could get out in front of those people and I could work them. I could pull them in.
Sure.
I could push them away.
Feel
I
the
could
timing.
At 18. So I was a natural. There was a lot I didn't know, but I was a natural at it. Kept going to college. Got a break. Went to New York City. Joined Circle Repertory Company.
But what about your folks? Were they into it?
My dad ran a lumber company and I'm the oldest son.
How many kids?
Three. My brother runs it now. But I was being groomed to
be the lumber guy.
Family business. It would have been third generation. And I took trigonometry, I took geometry, I took algebra, I barely...
For lumber?
Things have to fit in houses.
Yeah.
That takes geometry.
You have to be able to tell the customer.
But when you're pulling a D+ after studying 3 hours the night before with your father, and you're still pulling a D+ on the test, and you're throwing the book up in the air, and your dad's going, this is just not going to...
Yeah. No basketball, no lumber for this kid.
Well, then I got and they saw it. They saw this natural ability in this kid.
Yeah.
And the teacher had said, the choir teacher, the musical director, just kept saying, watch this kid. There's something going on. I don't know how good he is, but this is unusual.
Which is also, on some level, horrible news for parents. Like, guess what? Your kid might have a future in show business.
Well, but we're in the Midwest. We don't know what show business is.
Isn't that weird? You don't, do you?
No. And New York City is a place where people go to die.
Yeah.
You know?
By getting shot or whatever.
Yeah. It's the 70s. Yeah. It kind of did go. It's before Rudy saved the day.
Right.
You know?
Way before. And the city was depressed and broken.
Oh, my God.
Bombed out.
And Son of Sam hadn't happened yet. Yeah. It was just...
Just drugs and weirdness everywhere.
Yeah, and hang on, gay people.
Yeah,
they live there.
Right.
So but they looked at that, and I remember coming home. I did a thing at a college that the artistic director of Circle Repertory had come out to pick up a check to direct some college kids. The head of the department at Eastern Michigan University was his old college friend from Northwestern. And he's directing a bunch of college kids. Marshall W. Mason, would you come out and direct these college kids?
Right.
Got the lead in Summer and Smoke and Hotel Baltimore. And before Marshall went back to New York, he said, you know what you should do with your life, don't you? And I'm 21 and I go, well, you know, I think I like to be an actor.
Yeah.
He said, you should come to New York. You should join the Circle Repertory Company as an apprentice. No guarantees, but you should chase acting. So I went home with my lumberyard father and my housewife farmer mother.
Yeah. She comes from farmers?
Farmers. And I said, this is what I'm being offered. And my dad looked at my mom and he looked at me and he said, you should go.
Really?
Pretty good.
That's great.
Pretty good.
Did you grow up with, was it a conservative household? Were you, hammered with?
Republican moderates.
Yeah.
Republican moderates.
So decent people.
But.
A little nervous.
They said you should go.
Yeah.
There was no hesitation. There was.
Did it surprise you?
They saw it.
Did you get emotional? I mean, was it one of those things where it was like you wanted to? No.
No, because I think it was, why don't you go? And it wasn't even go and try. And then when you fail, come home and you'll put you in. I knew I had the lumber company.
Yeah.
I might have been on the counter going, what would you like today? But I knew I had the lumber company.
The simple son. Were the younger brothers running things?
Yes, I would have been working for my younger brother. Definitely.
Yeah.
But no, I have to see this through.
Yeah.
And then I went to New York and waited to fail.
And this was 72?
76.
Okay. So where do you move? You first get here, you must have, had you been here before?
No, I stayed with Marshall for a couple of weeks, and then I got a one-room apartment on 23rd and 7th Avenue.
Okay. What was going on over there then? Not much.
Not much.
Chelsea. It was Chelsea, though, kind of, almost.
Yeah, it was 23rd and 7th.
Yeah.
The next year, Son of Sam happened. Also, the blackout. Remember the blackout?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was understudying on Broadway, and then blackout happened, walked down to my apartment. I was on the 10th floor, no lights, no elevator.
Calls from home? Are you okay?
No.
Be careful, Son of Sam.
No.
No, no.
I heard the lights didn't go on,
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't go on.
So what was this? How did this Circle rep work? So you come out here, you're the new guy. Who are the big guys? You're apprenticing? I mean, what are you watching?
Apprenticing, it was a company of people that, they had done Hotel Baltimore. Judd Hirsch was in that. Soon after I came, Bill Hurt showed up.
Oh, yeah?
Chris Reeve showed up.
Oh, that was that crew.
Yeah, but there was a group of people, John Hogan, Danton Stone, Stephanie Gordon, Tanya Barrison, Trish Hawkins, Nancy Snyder, solid from... who had been taught by Marshall Mason. This is kind of listening, reactive acting.
Yeah.
That you are part of a whole. Don't try to stand out.
That was the training?
Yeah, and it served me really well in film as a supporting actor, which is how I really started out.
So none of the, you didn't do any of the Meisner, Stanislavski method?
He took Stanislavski, he took Meisner, who took it from Stanislavski, yeah, and created his own thing. It was like a third step, what Marshall did. Uh-huh. So it was based on Stanislavski, based on Meisner, but Marshall wrote his own book on it, and that's the book I use today.
And those guys like Reeves and Hurt, they came out of Juilliard, right?
They came from elsewhere. And yeah, so there was a bit of a speed bump for those of us who were trained under Marshall.
Yeah.
And but, you know, Bill, extremely talented. Chris, talented. You know, they fit in. But it wasn't the same as those of us who had been through it.
Right. Because they, like, someone like Hurt, it seems awfully thinky.
Stinky?
Thinky.
Thinky.
Yeah, like, you know.
I have never, that, is that a word?
Yeah, I used it a lot.
Where, it,
you
is
know,
now.
Thinky, where he, you know, just, he seems to process. You know,
there's a process going on with Bill. There's some cerebral stuff.
Yeah.
But he's fun. All you got to do is poke him.
Yeah.
And I then, mean, with a sharp object, but you got to poke him and then he's there. Yeah.
So what, so you apprentice for how long? What does it mean to apprentice?
Apprentice means you, I went right. He had a part for me. This was the spring when he said, why don't you come to New York? In the fall, he had a part for me. It was a play called The Farm by David Story. Richard Gere had done it the, like 6 months earlier.
Yeah.
And Richard got the Terrence Malick movie. I forget which.
Oh, yeah, Days of Heaven, maybe?
That one. He got that, I think that, with Brooke Adams.
Right.
So Richard couldn't do it. Gere couldn't do it. And he found me and said, Jeff can do this part. Why don't you come and be an apprentice? And the first thing I'm going to do is put you in a play at Circle Rep off Broadway. Didn't have a clue what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
And really let Marshall down, I think. And
really?
Yeah.
Didn't go well?
I wasn't the guy in Summer and Smoke. I just got scared.
Sure.
And
you felt that? It's a horrible feeling on stage, isn't it?
Yeah, you just feel like you're around people that know a hell of a lot more than you do, and it shows. But the critics were whatever the critics were. But Milton Goldman, who was running ICM at the time, big agency in New York City, was there to see Jack Gwillem, his 65-year-old client, who was playing the father in the play.
Right.
And he saw this kid, and he said, I want to meet the kid. And he hauled me up, and it's everything. It's Milton Goldman. It's the
you knew about him. You knew enough about
him. I didn't
his.
Know anything. Oh. It's the posters on the wall. It's the little kid, and Milton's going in the formal suit behind his desk at 10 in the morning, going, you're good enough to Circle Up and Marshall Mason. You're good enough for ICM. Tell me a little bit about yourself, kid.
Yeah.
Well, I was just in Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, and he started laughing, and he said, and he wouldn't stop laughing, and I said, no, I was good. He goes, yeah. Eric, come here a second. I want you, come here. Tell him what you just told me. Tell Eric what you just told me. I was Tevye and Fiddler. Now he's laughing. And he goes, you're going to be fine, kid. You'll be fine. Go down to the commercial department.
Yeah.
We're going to put you in some Listerine and some McDonald's, and, you know, we're going to get you on that.
Did
so
you do
I
that?
Did commercials for like 5 years.
Yeah, so you started making money as an actor, though.
Yeah. I didn't have to wait tables. Because I would make just enough on, I'd get one out of 30 commercials that I go up on.
Any memorable commercials?
I did about 12. Pepto-Bismol.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
In the 70s.
In the 70s, yeah. Pepto-Bismol. I was a student at the University of Mexico City, and my parents from Long Island, with a camera around the neck and the Hawaiian shirt, came down to visit me at the University of Mexico City. And they said, how you doing, son? I said, pretty good. This was a, you know, precursor to Dumb and Dumber. Pretty good. I just took a test. There are 500 of us have diarrhea. And 250 of us took Pepto-Bismol. And I was one of them. And boy, does it work. Cut it. That was it. That was the spot.
That's a hell of a setup for a Pepto-Bismol commercial. They went right to it.
Not only that, but you have to call your parents and going, you know, this week on, you know, Mannix, in the 8:30 hour, you'll see the Pepto-Bismol commercial. And they call all their, you know, their bridge club friends. And
right. There you go. There you are. Talking about diarrhea.
There's my son.
But it was sort of interesting. It was like a real fear mongering about dysentery, about everything that you're afraid of about eating in Mexico. There it is. There's 250 of us with diarrhea from being in Mexico.
But there's a cure.
Yeah, Pepto-Bismol. Yeah. So it was before the, like,
that. Yeah, commercial. It was before that. I didn't have to do that.
So then after those commercials, when do you start to, did you stay at ICM? Like, are you still
I'm
at
I'm still there. I haven't moved. Paul Martino was an agent at the time. He picked me up in 1980. He's my manager now. And Eddie Ablanz started his mail as Paul Martino's receptionist at Paul Martino's office. This is Eddie Ablanz. Now he runs movies in L.A.
That's how it happens. You got to be nice to all those
people. So I've been
with
Eddie and Paul since 1980.
I made my mistake was made when I had no respect for any of them. And
you told them
assistants, whatever. I was just an asshole. And then all of a sudden they're running the business. And you're like, you don't remember when I was younger. Yeah, I do. You fuck. And I, I'll never forget that. Good luck with your career.
That's true.
Yeah. They don't. They have a long, they're like elephants. So when does how did you start doing the movies? When did that break? How did that happen? Was it the Jonathan Demme movie?
After about 3 years of Circle Rep.
Did a lot of plays at Circle Rep?
Quite a few. 5th of July was the one that I really rode that one. Lanford Wilson wrote it. We did it off Broadway, then we did it in L.A. And
you started in it.
Yeah, well, I was one of about 7 or 8 people, and Lanford, every part was a great part. So that was my ticket. That just kept me working and kept me in what money you could get in the theater.
Do you love theater?
Love theater.
Because you did a lot of it. You've done more of it than I think most film actors already.
I think so.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to do movies. Theater was my ticket to movies.
But that was always the idea.
Well, yeah. I saw Dog Day Afternoon when I was in college in 76, before I moved to New York. I saw it 6 times. I kept going back to it. And I wanted to figure out what Pacino was doing. I wasn't getting taught that. Every scene was so alive and so, I went so I could think, I thought I could see the script.
Yeah.
And I thought I could see him improv. And then I could see the choices.
Right.
None of which I knew until like 3 years at Circle Rep, where I understood what choices are. You know, De Niro said an actor is only as good as his choices. You get the script. What are you going to do with it?
Right.
And so I was just doing it. I didn't think about it. So I said, wherever I have to go to figure out what Pacino is doing and how he does that, I'm going to go there. And so that was New York.
Interesting. So it was the third thing down, the choices. You know, like you saw, like,
I wasn't even aware of choices. Just,
right.
You do it. You didn't even think about it. So
yeah, and when you do it that way, it's sort of like you know, it's a free fall in a way. I mean, right? Because choices at least give you something to land on. You
learn all this stuff later.
Yeah, yeah.
Know,
no, I
in the
just,
acting club, but you know, initially it. Coming out, it was just like I did. I think people seemed to like what I did. You know, the Marshall came to me after about 3 or 4 years at Circle Rep and said, look, the next season is this, that, and the other thing, and you're not in any of them. So this would be a really good time to go chase
a movie,
chase ICM. And I said, you know what? I'll go now. And it was very great. He'd been so great to me. And I said, I'm going to go to ICM and just let them have me. I'm not going to, well, you got to work around this play I'm doing at Circle Rep. No more. I'm going to go for a year or two and just go straight ICM. And that's when we started chasing movies. And there were a lot of auditions.
Yeah. Can I ask you a quick question about choices and about, like, when you do, like, I just saw you do Atticus Finch, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you put choices in place, what is the emotional choice? I mean, I know when you start, I'm going to say this like this, I'm going to turn this way, you know, I'm going to listen this way, or I'm going to engage here. But what is the driving force emotionally that you make, like for something like Atticus? Is it instinctual, or do you say this guy wants justice, this guy believes people are good? Do you put something in place like that for yourself?
I simplify as often as possible.
Yeah.
I want justice is too big.
Right.
I want Tom Robinson. I'm going to represent Tom Robinson. I want him to sign these papers.
Okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
For that moment.
That scene.
For that scene.
That's it. That's all you're there to do. Now, through rehearsal and through the choices and all that, you've got the accent, you've got the optimism of, no, you are, I am, they are completely wrong and I'm 100% right. You're innocent, Tom. You're innocent.
Yeah.
You walk in the door of that scene,
yeah,
going, I'm going to be your lawyer and here are the papers, sign the form in triplicate. And he signs the form and I go, all right, I'll see you tomorrow morning. That's all that's going to happen today.
So it's scene for scene, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sit with Scout on the bench and right, you explain to her what a mob means.
Right.
And how that's going to work for us. That's all you're doing. I'm just teaching my daughter.
Right.
You just happen to be watching.
Right.
How simple can you make it? I watch these actors, not in this show,
yeah,
but other actors.
We're not naming names, but yeah.
And they just discuss it and talk it and they get in their head that they think too much. I think, the less I can think about things, the more you're in free fall. Because if all you're doing is going to Tom Robinson saying, just sign the papers. And of course, there are obstacles to that. Every good scene is, you know, you aren't going to get what you want easily. Otherwise, there's no scene.
Right.
So here come the obstacles. And you've got to fight your way through those. With the same thing, I just want you to sign the paper. For your own benefit.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so you start going forward. You aren't sitting back going through all your notes, I got to show them this and I've got to make sure I look like that.
Right.
That's all horseshit. It's
right.
That it gets in the way.
Yeah.
You want one thing. What is it? Go get that.
Yeah. So you start chasing movies, a lot of auditions.
Yeah.
Are there any that you can think of that you're like, fuck, why didn't I should have got that.
Oh, a couple. Yeah. I was close on American Beauty.
For the Spacey part?
Yeah, Kevin was, they were trying to do his deal and it wasn't going well. And I met with Sam Mendes and I really wanted that one. It would have been a huge leap to put me in that. I was really nobody.
Isn't that a weird position to have to accept? It's like, we're going to use you as leverage to get Kevin to...
I was a backup.
Right.
And he didn't offer it.
Right.
And I imagine there were two or three other guys that were, you know,
in that position.
Short list if Kevin's deal didn't come through. And then his deal came through and that was that. But that was like... That's the only one, really. I mean, it was...
You like that part?
Oh, it would have been a great part, but he did great in it.
Sure,
know?
Yeah.
I mean, what, you know, that's not to bitch about. But
what was the first movie, Something Wild?
Ragtime.
Oh,
I got into Ragtime.
That's right.
I had two or three scenes.
Yeah.
There's James Cagney.
Yeah.
81 years old, sitting there, and you're in the scene with James Cagney. Pretty special.
You did that.
Pretty special. You're in the room.
And he had that beard. He had like a curly mustache, right? Did he play that?
He had a curly mustache.
Was he the police chief or the fire chief?
He was the commissioner.
The police commissioner, yeah.
I remember him coming in. He didn't want to do it. He didn't think he could do it. He was retired at his upstate farm in New York. He wasn't acting anymore.
And yeah.
Milos Forman said, come on down to New York City. We'll do a screen test so that you can see that you can do it. And he reluctantly came down with his nurse, came in on a walker.
Yeah.
Sat there, and it was a four-page scene.
Yeah.
They brought in Kenny McMillan, the police chief, and three or four cops to just act around him. But we're in a studio at the PBS station here just to test Cagney, his request. And black and white monitors. This is 1980.
You're playing a cop?
I'm one of the cops back. I got one line or something. Four-page scene. He couldn't do it. Couldn't remember it. Couldn't
brutal.
Stay. It was, come on. Milo said, no. We cut down to three pages, down to one page. Cut it down to one page. Still couldn't do it. You say one line. You say one line, Jimmy. You say one line. And then, you know, we edit. We just say one line. And Jimmy, and you look up at the black and white monitor because they were shooting it.
Yeah.
And you could see it. You could see the medium close up. And all of a sudden, the jaw sets, and the finger comes up, and there's Yankee Doodle Dandy. There's everything. There's Cagney.
Yeah.
And it's still in there.
Yeah.
And Milo says, that is, we got it. You'll be good. We do one line at a time. You'll be beautiful.
One line at a time.
Yeah.
That's how you got to shoot those guys sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was Clint is the only other guy. Jack's another one. Those three guys... You know, when they go, Jack, how do you want me to do it?
Yeah.
And Jim Brooks says, well, I mean, you think, yeah, all right, boom, boom. And you look at the monitor, and then all of a sudden there he becomes, and Clint, I did a movie with Clint, Bloodwork, and he just casual, easygoing, Yeah. Plays golf.
Right.
He's that guy.
Yeah.
And then he sits in there and you got the camera. Yeah, you got it ready. All right, good. All right. Anytime you're ready. What? That was action. That was, by the way, that was action.
Yeah.
And you say the line and you watch Clint set the jaw, do the speech. And then at the end of it goes, all right, that's enough of that. And it's done. But you see him become it. And then come out of it.
On camera.
On camera.
I just had that experience because I couldn't figure it out. Because I was, you know, working with De Niro and watching him trying to get the lines in his head and whatever. But then you watch it, the pictures of it, or you watch it on the monitor and you're like, it's like you can't even explain it. I guess it's just years of experience or they live on the screen.
Oh, there's so much technique that you learn how to forget it. And these guys, Nicholson said, you gotta know what the muscles in your face do. And you know, winger, Deborah said to me on Terms, she said, you lead with your eyes. Just little things that, you know, on stage, you've got the whole body you're looking at.
Right.
So when you say something there, sometimes there's a physical adjustment to pull focus to you to hit this line.
Yeah.
But on film, you lead with the eyes. You follow where your eyes look.
You make a note of that.
And then you forget them. And then you do them. That's what these guys know instinctively now.
They know which camera's on them. They know what
they know what this looks like when they do this. They know what this looks like when the Altman, Robert Altman said, give me a reveal, Jeff. What? Where you're looking down and then you come up and you say the line. Then I worked. It was beautiful. It was a great movie trick. And then I was doing a movie with someone who shall be named. Who will be nameless. And every single line was a reveal.
Oh, really?
Every single line.
Just the
all of them.
Yeah.
Always found a way to look away and then come back up. Always looked away and then came back up. And you just wanted to look. What are you looking at? What's down there?
Which movie did you do with Altman?
What was that? Caine Mutiny Court Martial. It was a TV, CBS TV thing. With Brad Davis, Peter Gallagher, Eric Bogosian.
Seems like you got to work with a lot of great guys.
I did. I did. Altman was... That's where you learn how to improv. Altman is famous for... he mics everybody.
Yeah.
And then he says, you're going through the door. Yeah, just you and your lawyer are going through the door, all right? And then what he doesn't tell you is that he's sending three people through the door from the other direction. Action. And then you're doing the dialogue and and then one of those guys other guy says something to you and now you're what happened? Cut it. We got that. That's Altman.
Yeah, just like threw all the obstacles at you in real time.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to catch it on camera. Good, I got it. Clint's the same way.
You only
do one take. One take. He wants it to happen for the first time and it does.
And then
that's free fall.
Yeah. And because you can't go back. Even in your mind, you're like, I could have done that better.
If we go back, blood work was, 10 weeks? We went back twice. You want another shot at that? Thank you. That would be great. Seeing how I butchered the speech. Yeah.
And did you start?
Means Clint can't use it.
Yeah. Right. Did you start in TV? Did you do little TV stuff?
I did some TV. The commercials really were a great, you're in front of a camera and you learn about that. You do a Burger King commercial where you're the kid in the back cooking the burgers and it's something about how great the burgers are. I don't know what the commercial is. And of course I did a whole 4-page backstory of him. You know, he's in high school, he's supporting his family of 7, the dad died, you know, and the director's going, just cook the burgers.
Yeah.
And
do you still do backstory?
Not to the extent that the acting classes think is so important. I do Givens. Circle taught me something called Given Circumstances.
Yeah.
Where's Atticus coming from? The backstory on, for instance, To Kill a Mockingbird, for me, is were all the books I read in the last 6-7 months to... I wanted to know what Atticus saw when he was standing on his porch. Goes beyond just Harper's book.
Right.
Jim Crow South, I got to know what that's about. And I got to know what it feels like in 1934 Alabama. Sundown towns. the Green Book stuff.
So you got to educate yourself to be.
You got to go to grad school on Atticus Finch. Yeah. You read Joe Crispino's book about Atticus. All of that. You got to go to school. Otherwise, you're not gonna get up and over Gregory Peck. You just aren't. So yeah. I said, let's get educated about what he was seeing, so that when Bob Ewell comes up on the porch in the play, I know that, you know, there's a lynching Thursday. You coming?
Right.
We had a good one about 2 weeks ago. We hung three of them. You coming? You ought to come. This special. Got some liquor for you.
Yeah.
And it's not, it's normal.
Right.
That's the normal. That's the common. And you got to understand that before you walk on stage as Atticus. And so it's get educated. Go to school. Know more about what's going on back then than the critics, than some other actor who might do it. That comes from the Midwest, too. There's a work ethic out there. We will work all day. We will look at the clock, but we will work until the job is done. And that's been instilled in me from my dad.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I told my kids. I said, you're only special because I'm famous. That might get you through a door or two, but then it's also there are one or two strikes against you because of that. Your only way to beat the guys who think, oh, you're just the, you know, special kid of the famous father, is you outwork them.
Are they all going into acting?
No. Oh. No. One thought about it, and then he just didn't. I said, you got to want it more than anything. And he goes, I don't. I said, well, then why don't you be the star of your own life? Why don't you go find out what you want to do? The only privilege you have is that you have time to find what you want to do versus what you have to do to make a living.
Yeah.
So you have that. I'll give you that. That's your privilege. But you got to work your ass off. You got to outwork other people. And you have to be a professional. You have to be responsible, accountability, all that stuff that I learned as an apprentice, a circle rep, and my dad taught me. My theater company, that's what we teach. Are these kids and actors going to go off to be famous and be in movies? No. Some might, but most won't.
Yeah.
So what are you going to take away? Professionalism, discipline, behavior, accountability, responsibility, be a pro. And that means you outwork everybody else. Get to work.
Do you find a lot of the people that come through the your program know that they may not be famous?
There are a few that have the dream, because the dream came true is standing right next to him.
Right.
Because I'll walk into the theater company, I'll write a play, and there I am. And it, you know, it can happen. But 7 years in New York City before I got a movie.
But it's interesting, like I see it all the time, where there's no way to tell somebody that it's over. Only they can tell themselves that. This business is ridiculous.
You're the last one to know.
Of course, because you keep setting your precedent higher. It's like, well, that guy didn't make it till he was like 60. You know, like,
okay.
You know what I mean? Like, it's so like, it's sort of there's a sadness to show business.
Oh my God.
That is undeniable.
You sit with college kids, which I do occasionally, which I enjoy, because you can't, what you start is, let me talk to you about rejection.
Right.
And why you're going to need, you know, antidepressants at some point.
Or something.
Something.
So, yeah.
Something. So you're going to need some medication.
Yeah.
Nothing can prepare you for that. It's just, how bad do you want it? And by the way, how talented are you? You got to look in the mirror. Be honest.
That's it. What are your limitations?
Are you really that talented?
Right.
Do you want to be Al Pacino? Are you that talented?
Yeah.
If you aren't, then shoot for something less. And many people do. Yeah. But I said, I can't tell you that. I can't tell you whether you're talented enough.
Right. But they're all sitting there going, I got it. I got it.
Okay. Good luck. Good luck to you. All right. Get back to me. And when you're, I remember I was in a bar after a play and Richard Dreyfuss was there.
Oh yeah.
And he was at the peak of his career. You know, he was working with Spielberg. He was doing the whole thing.
Jacked up.
I don't know about that, but it was a cool table to be at, and I don't know how I got there. And I was 22, and Richard saw me, and he goes, are you an actor? I said, yeah, I'm just starting out. He goes, it doesn't mean shit till you're 30, and he walked away. But there was something to that. Put in your time.
Yeah.
Learn the craft. Learn the techniques.
Yeah.
Don't just walk in the room on the, you know, riding the brilliance of your personality and charm. That ain't going to make it.
Wait, and you did the Demi movie?
Demi was later. Something Wild was later.
Really?
There was Terms of Endearment. There was Marie.
Terms of Endearment was before Something
Wild? Oh, yeah. That was 83. Terms was 86. Or Terms was 83. Something Wild was 86.
Terms was like, I watched that again recently because I talked to Brooks not too long ago.
I love Jim. Yeah.
Oh, he's a great guy.
Oh.
And that was like, and that movie's great. I mean, like that cast, like, I mean, it must have been just insane to not.
Yes, it was around. Insane.
I can't, I mean, Shirley MacLaine sitting there and Jack's on set, and you're all kind of on set at the same time, right?
Yeah. There was definitely a relationship, dysfunctional thing working between Deborah and Shirley. And then Jack showed up after 2 weeks of shooting. I mean, Shirley and Deborah, what it was, I thought, was Deborah going, we have a mother daughter relationship that is love hate.
Yeah.
And we're going to make sure we get the hate in there.
Yeah.
Because right. Shirley was a little bit, let's just make it, you know, she had a way that she was going to do it, and Deborah wasn't going to allow her to do that. And I watched that happen, which was an education. And then Jack shows up after 2 weeks of pretty much strife and stress on the set. And Brooks was trying to get in there and trying to make it work. And just, you know, I mean, the girls were, it was rough.
Yeah.
And Jack so shows up and says, why are you having such a problem? he was great. And as soon as Jack showed up, everybody got along. Everybody was fine. Jack said, do you want me to wave like this or should I wave like that? Jim says, try the second one. I'll try the second one. And he'd back up the car and he'd wave like the second one. You got it? Yeah. Well, I think we got it.
And I like the way he kept looking up at the stars.
Yeah.
Like he had this weird thing.
Yeah.
He'd been there before.
Oh, my God. It was just great. Shirley had butterflies, adhesives in her, just under her hair. And it pulled the forehead back. So it made her younger, which is an old Hollywood trick. Yeah. Terrific. Brooks wanted them out. And he couldn't get Shirley to take them out. So Jack's doing the, I'm sitting on the fence across the driveway from, and he's meeting Shirley for the first time. And Jack says, yeah, I'll get him out for you. Rolling, action. So you're an astronaut. Yeah, I'm an astronaut. I'm kind of a, what do you got in your hair there? I can't help but see what you got. No, cut it. Jack, those are adhesives. I'm just reacting to what I'm seeing. Just, every take he would do, finally, bing, 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 bing. She pulls him out. He looks over at Jim, winks. Oh, that was pretty good.
And it was great that it kind of forced her into a different place with it.
And God bless Shirley. She really, you know, at the time, she and God, to be fair to her, Deborah had just done Officer and a Gentleman. She was it.
Yeah.
She was it.
Right.
And Shirley used to be it.
Right. Yeah.
So there was that. And it became about in the Nebraska, the hospital scenes later in the movie. He wanted the roots to show. He didn't want the perfect hair and all of that. Jim did, and Shirley fought him on that. And Shirley said, Jim said, I want you to fall apart physically. Yeah. And, you know, for an actress to do that later, that's a lot. That's asking a lot. But she did it.
She did it.
Yeah.
I get choked up just now thinking about it. I don't know. Kind of.
She won the Oscar.
Yeah, she did. Yeah. So, like, okay, so I obviously we can't go movie to movie, but Something Wild had a profound impact on me just because I think...
That was improv. There was a lot of improv on that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't what I think of as improv, but it really was. That was Jonathan Demme before he was really Jonathan
Demme.
Right,
and it had a feel of a movie that, like, something you'd never seen before. There were colors in it. There was a pace, the music.
Music.
Like, and it just had... a style that was like I had never really seen before. He was very highly stylized right out of the gate.
Yeah.
And to work with him, what was he like to work with? Did you learn from him?
There was no such thing as a bad idea.
Right.
Oh, try it.
Nice. Yeah.
He could have had $100,000 to make the movie or $100 million.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have mattered. Jonathan would have approached it the same way. We get to make a movie today. Come on, let's go. Let's try that. You'd look out the window and there's a dog sitting on the back of a motorcycle and the dog has a helmet on.
Yeah.
And you're going, this is a Jonathan Demme movie. It's the same feeling I had the year before working on Woody with Purple Rose. You look around you and you go, this is the frame of a, and you're seeing things in it that only would be in a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah.
And you realize you're with a filmmaker. Same thing with Jonathan, same thing with Altman, same thing with Clint.
And you've also worked with guys who are just doing the job as opposed to a filmmaker.
Or are told to just do the job because, you know, what? It was a different time. And maybe television is getting back to that.
Yeah.
Where Aaron Sorkin gets to run Newsroom with Alan Poole and a couple other people. And they aren't told what to do.
Right.
It's like that. It's Coppola. You know, even though Coppola had to fight and to get Pacino in the into The Godfather, he still had his battles. But the director was king,
right,
or queen. And that went away. Suddenly there were 17 producers on the front of the movie. And they all got to get their notes in. And that's not great. Too many cooks. That's why Squid and the Whale with Noah Baumbach, the budget was what, $1.1 million or something? That's like $20. There was nobody else. So when we have to make a change at 2 a.m, it's Noah Baumbach and Laura Linney and me. There is no phone call to LA to go, is this okay if we do this?
Well, that's why those guys shoot like that. That's why they make the choice to keep the movie small.
So but it's single voice.
Yeah.
Singular voice.
Right.
Same thing with Sorkin.
Right.
So, you know, that's, and I love that. I miss that.
But I guess the difference is that somebody like Baumbach is going to keep making these smaller movies because he can wrangle his own sort of funding and he can have control of the movie.
Control, creative control. Whereas it's all about creative control.
Aaron has made people fortunes. So, like, you know, he can operate at a different level and they're going to give him everything he needs.
Creative control.
Right.
Creative control.
Just the upper, the different, like the big money.
You know, Spielberg fought for Final Cut. Creative control.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's about. It's not about, and that is hard to get. You have to be somebody to get that at a high level, or you do a budget of $1 million so that they don't bother you.
Right. And with the theater, with your theater, the Purple Rose, is it called the Purple Rose Theater?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how much are you writing? How many plays are you kind of producing on
your own? I've written 17, and the one I have up now in the fall here is Diva Royale. I wrote Flint, which we produced in January. I just love writing plays, and it's creative control. I work with one person, the artistic director, and he and I collaborate. We work well together, but in my theater, the playwright is king. And
you're developing playwrights and actors?
Yeah, we have 6 playwrights, men and women, who write, who are always writing the next play. And you got to produce these people. Their first play is, you get it in as best shape you can, and you got to produce it. And their next play will be their 5th, simply because you produced it. I can't stand the theater companies that do staged readings or workshops of the play, development hell,
yeah,
and they won't produce it. They'll bring in what was popular in New York last year because it's published, because doing a new play is really hard. You got to originate. You got to make those original choices. You got to cut this scene. You don't cut scenes in Arthur Miller. You know,
right,
you shouldn't. Tennessee Williams. You can just do it the way it's written. And it's hard to do, but if you can figure out how to do it and how to tell story on a stage, structure, what you need, what you don't, take that joke out because you're spending a whole page just to get to that joke, kill the babies, as we say in writing, you learn how to do that. And then you get a voice, and then you get Lauren Knox or Kerry Krim or Jeff Daniels or Dave McGregor, and you get these, and people start to come to see the writer. They come to see the writer. He or she has written another play.
Yeah.
And by the way, why don't you write about the people in the seats? You know, not always, but I prefer to write about people sitting in those seats. Hold a mirror up to them. I don't care what you think as the playwright.
Yeah.
That doesn't interest me. I care what you think about what they think.
Yeah.
And if you write about them, they will come. And by the way, if you make it funny once in a while, they'll bring their friends.
Yeah. And now is it self-supporting, the theater now?
Nope, we're nonprofit. Our budget's a little over $2 million a year. The box office, we demand a lot of the box office. We've got to bring in 60% box office, something like that.
And are people coming to from all over the world to be part of it, or is it mostly?
No, I mean, regionally. Yeah. I mean, we're certainly, the audience is a 90-mile radius.
Right.
We draw actors from Chicago who come out to audition for us.
Oh, yeah.
But we develop the people there.
Okay.
We take them, we put them through the same acting program I had at Circle Rep, they get. The same apprentice program is the same one at Purple Rose. And we teach you how to do what we call being purple. And it's just listening and reacting and keeping it on the stage. That's what it's about. So,
have you worked with who I talked to? Tracy Letts. You know Tracy Letts?
I don't know. I may have met him. I've never worked with him, though. He's another guy. Yeah. I mean, he's a pure artist.
Yeah.
He's a great American artist. And everything the guy writes is just gold.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah, keep writing, Tracy. Don't ever stop writing.
Yeah. Now, you've got the Emmy for Godless.
Yeah.
I saw you over there. I was at the Emmys sitting there. It's kind of a tedious evening, isn't it?
Oh.
I walked by you and I was like, I'm not going to say hi to that guy. He doesn't look too happy today.
No, it's just my overall look. I'm just not as euphoric as everyone else is, you know, about this incredible opportunity to wear a tuxedo and probably lose.
Yeah.
It's probably an impossible show to do.
I guess so.
And maybe what we should all do with all these shows, since this isn't really a competition, really,
right,
is take it off television.
It doesn't
put
mean
it
as
back
much.
At the Roosevelt Hotel banquet room and hand out the awards and
let people have fun.
People have fun.
Yeah.
Why do we have to televise it? You know, and I know why we have to televise it. But
Is it important to you? Does it feel good to win?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. You don't go there not to. You know. But look, to be invited to the party.
Yeah.
I felt this the first time I got nominated for the Tonys with God of Carnage. That was the first time I felt, you know what, win or lose, we're not here to win because there's the Jeffrey Rush and there's some. And you're looking around, you're going, I'm part of a lot of great work. Just enjoy that, you know?
Right.
And I did. I really got it for the first time, which is different than watching it as an actor on television.
So just a couple of years ago, you finally...
And you're never invited. And you're I never liked him. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, he shouldn't have won. He sucks.
My friend Kravitz used to call the television the resentment box.
Yeah, I was, Oscars, about 15 minutes into the Oscars, and I'm in the other room. I can't do it. I just can't do it. There's just too much bitterness and hate and rage. But then you win, and you win for Newsroom, which you're not supposed to win. You're not supposed to win. There was an audible gasp in the audience when my name was called. The New York Times wrote about it.
The gasp?
The audible gasp when Mr. Daniels' name was called, because it was Spacey and it was Ham, it was Damian Lewis, it was Brian, it was just loaded, and we got it. I had the Northwestern speech. They didn't have that. Mm-hmm. That's what did it, I think. But then with Godless, you wanted that because I took a risk. I took a big risk.
Playing
with that.
Heavy.
The beard and the thing and the Western, and it easily could have been, oh my God, what is he doing? He took a risk, and I wanted it. I worked hard on that, and then I was glad to win. Yeah. But it wasn't. It wasn't the euphoric. I'd like to thank everyone. Oh, my God.
Didn't you talk about the guy who had your horse?
I thanked the people that my driver.
Yeah.
I thanked Mark Warwick, my wrangler, who saved my life one day when the horse threw me off. And he saved my life.
Yeah.
And then I thanked my horse just to let them know that let's all just calm down just a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a great honor. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah,
I'm gonna thank my horse, and let's all think about that. Let's all think about who has anyone ever thanked their horse?
Not
maybe John Wayne.
Right.
Google it. Go look it up. Get back to me.
Gene Autry.
I'm gonna say no.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's do that.
Not since Trigger.
Not since Roy Rogers and Trigger.
But these eras, you know, like something like when you talked about Atticus and about researching Atticus, and then about like, but less so in terms of going to the old West, which is something we grew up with, which is like a genre that, you know, comes and goes. But did you feel the weight of it? Did you feel like, I mean, I have to assume that with Atticus, when you did all that research, that to really engage with that, the heartbreak of it has to be there with you on stage, that this is the way humans behave.
Yeah, you gotta delete the movie because that's not helpful.
Yeah,
I can't use it. I can't do what he did. I'm not gonna.
Right.
Goodbye. The book is the source, but it's the play. It's Aaron Sorkin. Atticus makes a change. He goes through a change in this. Less so in the movie, and probably less so in the book, because it's truly from Scout's POV. The play is more about the change that happens to Atticus. So you have to, again, simplify. I want to win this case for Tom Robinson. My first two criminal clients were the last two people hanged in Macomb. So this is going to be the one I'm going to win. It's going to be good for me as a lawyer. Going to do something good for Judge Taylor. And I'm going to get this guy off who's absolutely innocent. That's what I'm going to do. And it's a slam dunk case. Walk face first into that. And then the story is going to take that away from you. Now what do you do? And it can't be just righteousness and being a Mount Rushmore statue about it. You got to go through it. He's a human being, a living, breathing human being. And he just lost. And this guy's going to the electric chair. I'll get him on the appeal. And then they shoot him.
Yeah.
And you got to go through that. You got to go through that. And it may not be what they did before, but it's what we're doing now. And you get Atticus to kind of go through that emotionally. And then his son is guilty probably of killing Bob Ewell. I have three kids. What would happen if your son?
Yeah.
And the sheriff is going, let's go outside and talk on the porch.
And you can feel that.
Whoa. You bring it with you. You use it.
Yeah.
You use it. I'll tell you the other thing, too, is my dad was an Atticus Finch. He was the guy that everybody in town went to get advice. There was right and there was wrong. There was how you treat people. He was that glorious Republican moderate who hired the poorest guy in town to clean the lumber company. I remember coming home, 8, 9, 10, walked into our living room. There's my dad sitting with a black man, a guy named Herbie Pearson, one of the two black families that had won it. He had just moved to town. Dad heard about him. Dad had Herbie come to his house. I walked in there laughing at the kitchen table with a black guy. I'm like, Jeff, I'd like you to meet Herbie Pearson. Herbie's going to be working for me. And he was also the guy who said, when you go to school, because we were in small town standards well off, small town well off. He owned a business. It was doing okay. We had money comparatively. He goes, you find the poorest kid in your class. And if you find that people are making fun of him, you stand next to him. You be friends with the people on the other side of town. Yeah. And that's Atticus.
Right.
And I was. And it led me into the theater because that the misfits of the... And so I wish he were alive to see this.
Yeah.
Because my brother and sister are coming to opening night. And I look like him facially. They're going to see him.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to hear him.
That's going to be great.
Yeah. So it's personal.
Yeah.
To get this opportunity, which is... I'm so fortunate, but... You know, my wife had said the other day, people have asked, and is there a role of a lifetime that you wish you could play? King Lear, Hamlet, you know, and I never had one.
Yeah.
And she said, you've got it now, don't you? And I said, yeah, this is it. Every night is a joy. It really is.
That's
great. I wish he could see it. I wish he could. If you believe in that stuff, I guess he is.
And... Well, that's beautiful, man. That's so good. So in closing, any notes on how to transcend resentment?
I think you need to embrace your resentment.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm working on that.
Uh-huh.
I can go to instant rage, and it's always about lying, cheating, stealing, not being truthful, you know.
Yeah.
it's raining and they're pissing on my forehead and they're telling me, you know, all the stuff that's going on today.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with playing hardball.
Right.
With what's going on now. If that's the game, then I think those who are with the resistance in a peaceful, nonviolent manner start throwing right hooks.
Yeah.
If that can be nonviolent. But yeah, do not shy away from that. So that channel that resentment.
Yeah. We can make it about something. Aside from our,
And
our
but I have, I will always, and I will always rise up for people who don't do the work, who feel entitled, who aren't prepared.
Yeah.
You don't have to outwork me because you're not gonna, but if you're not even doing the minimum, then you're going to hear about it.
Yeah.
And if I don't know if that's resentment, but that'll out comes the rage when that happens.
Right. Well, it's good that, yeah, I mean, you know, it's reasonable. It's the unreasonable
rage. It's for
rage.
A reason. Yeah, the unreasonable rage is
worse. Yeah.
No, that's...
it's like
that's,
being a six-year-old.
You know? Up the medications.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you. I don't think we need to play guitar. You that's need to fine. Save your voice.
That's fine.
But you love playing it.
I do. Yeah. You play well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I've been playing. I've been practicing. I keep practicing.
I'm
not sure what I'm practicing for.
It's all I do.
It's great.
I get those Stefan Grossman videos. And
oh, you do? So you sit with it?
Oh, my God. Stefan Grossman, I got to meet him, and I got a lesson from him. And oh, it's a very long story. But but Pat Donahue is a guy. I got his DVDs that I'm just... That's what I'm going to do once we get past opening night, is sit in the dressing room with my download of Pat Donahue and Stefan Grossman.
Guy.
Yo, look him up. I mean, it's acoustic blues. Whatever you're doing, he does it better.
Sure.
And Kelly Joe Phelps.
Yeah.
I mean, these are guys
that
teach, and Keb Moe, that you just start going, I'm going to just learn how to do what they're doing, and then you're instantly better.
Yeah, I need some new tricks. Like, I never thought about it as a profession, so it's a very meditative, and I love doing
it. It's where I go to chill out. I mean, I used to play golf, and talk about rage.
Yeah.
You know, the 7-iron that stuck to the pin 3 feet today, you go out tomorrow and it's in the water. And I'm going, why is it in the weight? No, but you learn a riff on the acoustic guitar.
Oh, it's the best.
And it's there tomorrow.
Yeah, it's the best. And you don't have to Townsend your guitar at home.
No.
No reason to start breaking your guitar.
No.
Well, it's great talking to you, man.
Thanks
for
Mark.
Doing it.
I appreciate it.
I thought that was great. I really was happy that Jeff took the time and that we got to have that conversation, got to know each other a little bit. Just really great, memorable conversation. And now let's ease into some thoughtful two-chord guitar playing. Here we go.